Hey, welcome back to the AIMP Nashville Pubcast. It's your host, Tim Hunzey. We got a really good one for you guys today. I sat down with Annie Ortmeier. She is the co-president of Triple Tigers Records. And I knew it was going to be a good episode. I kind of had a gut feeling, but man, I'm telling you, this is a great one. She shares so much knowledge. She has quite an interesting career path. And I just think you're going to thoroughly soak all this in. So sit back and enjoy the ride. So I usually start off the same way. Annie, I asked my guests to give us a little background. And as stated, yours is a little more interesting than most people on a career trajectory. So I am excited to have you share.
Yeah, I've been in the music industry my entire professional career, which is 21 years now. And yes, mine was probably a little bit different. I did not attend a music school or a music business school. I studied communication, public relations at a small independent private school in Nebraska, which is where I'm originally from. And made my way to Nashville after college with an unpaid internship, of course, at the time, with CMT, Country Music Television, a part of MTV Networks and Viacom. And that really set me on this interesting trajectory of sort of going into first mover type positions in technology and music. And so one of those early roles was e-commerce before people really understood that or were working in it. I always like to say Amazon was maybe a couple years old at the time. And that created this pattern for my time at CMT to Ticketmaster, a Ticketmaster company where we were doing artist services, again, really focused on e-commerce, to running my own business for a while. And then to making my way to a label, Big Machine Label Group, and then from there to Universal Music in Nashville, and now to where I am at Triple Tigers Records. And I think the through line for all of those places and all of those career moves has been, if you're looking for someone to do something new, I'm the one to do it. And that has come up over and over again, that people have said in different roles at different companies, hey, I think we need this. Can you do it? And I have typically said, yes, I think I can do it and I'll figure it out.
Because you're coming out of the digital space. And when you digital marketing, when you say that, like, you built a lot in that realm. Kind of explain to us, what exactly does that mean? What is a day-to-day like? Like, what are you doing in that space, and how do people apply that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And in my 20 years of being in the industry, digital marketing has changed a lot. And that typically depended on the advent of new technologies. So when I talk to students or younger people in the industry that are getting started, I will remind them, as old and aged as it makes me sound, there was a time before Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and all of these social media networks that we know. And so we were really focused on email marketing and website building and e-commerce, early days of e-commerce, and how are we marketing, you know, music products and beyond that, merch, et cetera, to fans. And that also at one point included building online fan clubs. I worked for a time at that Ticketmaster company called Echo here in Nashville. And they were one of the first shops that were building artist websites, artist online stores, and taking fan clubs from being a physical sort of mail-in experience to a digital online message board environment, or something where the fans could actually congregate online. We probably look at them today sort of as like Facebook groups then, but they combining all that together and having a conversation primarily online with fans of country music. And then that evolved over time into, with the advent of social media, how are we building social media followings across all of those platforms, which I think anyone who worked in that time now would look back and say, we shouldn't have spent so much time, energy, and money to give up our audience to these outside platforms that now today have really turned into advertising platforms and make you pay to reach your own audience you worked so hard to build there. But that's sort of the currency of a lot of entertainment is all these social media networks. So a lot of then that evolved into with the advent of streaming, again, a new technology platform being introduced. I was really on the forefront of that in my time at Universal, becoming the streaming department and then building a pretty substantial streaming department that focused on all of the respective streaming department, streaming platforms that popped up. Obviously, Spotify, then Apple Music and Amazon Music came out in 2015. Pandora is definitely the OG among all of that, but getting those deals done with majors, both on the recorded side and the publishing side for Pandora and YouTube were really huge in that time too. And then learning how to work within those platforms, marketing across those platforms, the artists, the music, releases, et cetera. So it has evolved. And now, you know, the advent of TikTok being the newer social media, how do we work within that? So it has evolved pretty substantially in my 20 years. And what I have found is the pattern, I think, proves out. You really do have to be able and willing to adopt new technologies and new platforms when they are introduced, because they're typically going to change the game. And now I would say we're looking at AI as doing that same thing. And I think that one is less definable and more gray area than any of the others. So I'm truthfully trying to learn as much as I can there too, and watching how that evolves, but it feels like it has less of a clear path than some of these others. But that really is digital marketing, is staying on top of all of new burgeoning technologies and figuring out how to market music, your artists, merch, all the tickets, everything across all of those platforms as they evolve.
How have you, as a person that is like going down this new path, especially as we started moving to streaming, worked in this? Because there is no doubt in our business, radio is still king, and it's where I make most of my money. But I feel like that's been a battle and a challenge for you always, probably everywhere you went, to convince people. How has that been for you? And do you think people are being a little more open and aware and embracing of this change now?
Yeah, it has not always been easy, because change is not always easy at scale for especially entire industries. So at times I would say I would get really disheartening to be sort of a lone voice in a room full of folks, you know, that we're not agreeing on sort of what the next right step is or the path forward. One of the things that I have, you know, relied on and had to vocalize often is that this is not my personal opinion. This is not just something that I think when it comes to streaming related, data related conversations around songs, et cetera. When we have music in the marketplace and we're seeing how it's behaving in the streaming atmosphere across all the digital service providers, it's really what I've always thought. This is my hot take on it. I've always thought this is the kind of research that radio always wanted to be able to have. They wanted to be able to know what each individual listener thought of a song when they heard it on the radio. And we do have that one-to-one data now. We know if people are liking the song because there's an engagement metric on every platform to measure that, whether it be hearts or saves, et cetera. So we have that one-to-one data of how an audience is responding to a song now. And I think at first that was the hardest part for me to put my mind around, why people were so resistant to that. At first, because it seemed like in all my early years of being in the industry, I'd heard so much about radio research and how we were trying to find out what the audience wanted and what they thought of each individual song. And I thought, well, here's the simple answer. We know now, we can get all of this great data But I think early in the advent of streaming, the audiences had no overlap. There was a radio listening audience and a streaming audience. I think there was a time where those audiences crossed and it became much more obvious that you could have a song that was streaming instantly jump to radio and work. And that has evolved. And I've seen many iterations of that. A great example probably right now would be Ella Langley, but in the past it's been, you know, Morgan Wallen and Luke Combs and even Shaboozey with that song where it did so well on streaming and jumped off the platform, not just into radio, but into every other platform as well, right? And Luke Combs has done that. Morgan Wallen has done that. Shaboozey, Ella Langley is having that moment too. I sit back and go, well, we've reached this point where that doesn't need to be a conversation anymore, but it still is. And I do still think radio audiences are somewhat different than streaming audiences. They have crossover at some point, but I do still believe in the strength of radio. And I think artists still really want radio. I know publishers certainly appreciate radio. So
it pays a lot of bills over here.
Right. And so, you know, as in country music has remained the strongest radio format. I did see the other day that in a news article that I believe Christian radio has now actually overtaken country for the most radio stations in the U.S. amount quantity.
That's wild.
Yeah. That surprised me too. But otherwise, country has been the strongest music format for decades. And so if you're going to reach mass population and have the largest audience possible, you do still need radio. And I know a lot of this has been discussed that there aren't typically superstars as we view them today without at least some semblance of radio play as well. And I do still believe that. I think how the industry has evolved and changed and the conversations that have changed for me now have been less, hey, I'm seeing this song react online and I think we should consider this song for a single, to and having to argue some data points and fight for some of those things and try to fight for something I thought was performing really well from a data perspective and I thought was an early indicator the song was really good or really strong. Has now turned into a two-way conversation of how are, you know, radio folks and teammates asking how are those songs performing, and we're able to have a much more back and forth conversation about what is working best. And I think you have a question coming up about this too, so I won't jump to that story, the changing of the singles and things like that. But I think there is more an appetite from radio, it seems, to also move quickly to songs that are performing well on streaming or that are just busting off of the streaming services into the overall ether, into the pop culture conversation. There is more of an acceptance or more of an eagerness to immediately jump in and be a part of those songs too.
Well, this is a great segue to bring it back around to where you are now at Triple Tigers with Kevin Herring as the co-presidents of that, which also is kind of an interesting structure. Kevin being a radio guy, as we all know, and again, you being the more I'm into all the cool stuff that the kids need to know about kind of thing, digital world. How has that worked for you? I mean, I'm going to just be honest and be your bragger here that you guys are killing it right now on the outside and on the inside. You're signing great stuff, having a lot of success. So, but how's that working out for you? Like, it feels like this is a really unique company right now.
Yeah, I would say that it is. And, you know, going back to the beginning of Triple Tigers, which was founded in 2016, it was originally built as a radio promotion staff that also distributed their own music. That's really the origin of the label. And Kevin was hired very early on in that process as the SVP of promo and has 30 years in the industry at that point and is one of the best radio people I think this town's ever known or seen. And he's really well known and liked, and he was a great establishment player in that company. And you know, I think the statistic originally was like 11 of the first 15 singles that the label released went number one. That was the, one of the original stats. That has now evolved to we've had 15 number ones, because we were lucky to enjoy, three new ones last year. And, we're now sitting at a fourth one with, because Ella's been number one for the last couple of weeks. And, I think it's 15 out of 21 or some 20 or something like that. And the batting average of that is just insane. And I think all but one of those singles has charted at radio. Now, the origin of that, of this company is radio. And then when I was brought in a couple years ago, the idea was, hey, Triple Tigers 2.0, moving Kevin into the co-presidency role, bringing me in the co-presidency role to continue to build out marketing and everything else related to that outside, anything else really but radio. So I would say for the most part, Kevin and I have sort of our delineation of overseeing radio and I overseeing marketing and all the other pieces of the label. We still overlap pretty heavily on A&R together. So A&R as far as songs and singles, and then, you know, advising artists on record creation and things like that. But we really do let our artists go out and cut their records that they want to make and make the art they want to. And then we say, hey, we think these are the single ready songs and let's roll from there. So as you are familiar, and probably many people that listen to this are familiar, radio is a long game and can take a long time to ascend a chart. And a lot of what experience I bring is digital release strategy, marketing, digital marketing, advertising, expertise to the label. So a lot of what myself and my team, which is three other women, do is really set up and release, work with radio on setting up and releasing the singles. But then we can't just survive anymore on one radio single a year and waiting for that to peak before we talk about more music coming. So what we're doing all the time is digging in with the artist and team on additional digital only releases that continue to build our social audience, build our streaming audience. It definitely helps artists on tour. Yes, they've got to have that radio song that they're singing, but they've got to have other things to build out their set list and repertoire. So we continue to work on what those releases look like and build typically towards a project of some kind, whether it's an EP or an album. So really, we have kind of our lanes, and we definitely overlap and we advise and we talk regularly about that. But, you know, he really runs the radio team and I run anything that's not radio.
Yeah, I think that is just beautiful the way that works, to have both in the with your current experiences, as we've already clearly talked about, the strengths of both, because that's what you need. You need, if you can have the long tail of the streaming with the radio to, because it always surprises me anytime I say this on the podcast and people are like, I'm so surprised, like radio or record labels do not really profit off number ones. It actually costs y'all a lot of money to run a song up the chart.
Can. Yeah, it can.
Not when I say that, I mean not directly. Indirectly, as you mentioned, like it helps the artist tour. It obviously helps the notoriety, builds the brand, the whole thing. It helps them become that superstar. They need it. But the us publishers are the ones that really see the money off of that, number one. And it took me a while to figure that out as a young executive. But as stated, you guys are building both out in a very strategic way and have both of your strengths. And I think that's really great, because it's obviously proof that what y'all are doing is successful, because you have gotten to watch in the last couple of years these rocket ships known as Ella and Russell Dickerson, on top of the fact that you've had Scotty McCreery for such a while, long time, and that man is consistently ringing the bell and building out his career. But Russell and Ella particularly have taken some really unique rocket ships, man. What is that like to, maybe I posed the question this way, because these two are both very unique and had really breakout moments over the last year, is like, what's that like to witness? And was there a moment you knew that this was going to happen? Or is it just like this thing that happens so fast? You're like, holy shit, that just happened.
Yeah. Well, Ella, let me explain our relationship with Ella. Ella is signed to Columbia, New York, for full label representation, but Columbia, New York does not have a country radio team, promotion team. So we are hired and in collaboration, in partnership with Columbia, because we are all part of the Sony umbrella. So we're all in the family, and there were some previous relationships there among the teams. So, we work country radio promotion for Ella. We do not participate in all the amazing other things that Ella does, though her star shines so bright right now, and she's doing so many amazing things for country music. The whole industry is really being lifted up while she is rising. And I think she's introducing such cool, fresh new sounds that are benefiting the entire industry. And they're definitely benefiting Triple Tigers and opening up the doors for a lot of other opportunities. Russell is the flagship artist of this label 10 years ago, and really the label originally built around, has had a 10-year career and done well and had a number of number ones and sold pretty well from a music standpoint and ticket standpoint. But one of the things that I noticed when I got here 2.5 years ago was, to me, the man Russell Dickerson didn't meet the brand that I saw in Russell Dickerson elsewhere and outwardly. And so one of the things we did really early on when I got here was had a brand meeting, and I sat down and had some serious conversations with Russell about how he saw himself and what he wanted to do. And we created a mission statement. And then we pulled together every member of his team, from publishing and creative team, social management, label, everybody all together to say, what do we think Russell's brand is? And where's the disconnect? And there was a pretty big disconnect. And it wasn't, you know, that was just perception, right? This brand didn't meet who Russell really thought that he was. And so that is something we've worked on really hard for the last 2 years. We came away with a brand guide and a mission statement and words we use to describe Russell and words we don't. And we really jumped into, we've got to stay to this true north that is Russell Dickerson, the man. That will be the brand. And I can sort of confidently say now, 2 years in, I feel like we've reached that. People are understanding Russell Dickerson, the man, and that brand, and it is permeating with his music. And one of the things I noticed really early on that I said to him super early after I got here was, like, you don't really have a song that like fits your personality. Like, you have all these wonderful, beautiful love songs, and I know that's a part of who you are. But like, your personal one-to-one amazing joy that you bring to every day, it just, I mean, he's his own best hype man. He'll be your best hype man. He's my best hype man. Who's ever in the room with Russell, he's their hype man. He's such an uplifting personality. And I said, you don't have a song that like does that for you, that showcases that. And the funny story about happened to me is, he'd written that shortly before I joined the label. And I think he was in between management, and he'd sent it to some of the girls on my team that had been here. And they loved this song. They loved Happen to Me. And when we're having single conversations, end of 23, I asked him, do you remember Happen to Me? He was like, that song? Oh yeah. Okay. Yeah. I kind of forgot about it. And I was like, it's freaking great. Why don't we cut it? So he went in to cut end of 23, and he was just going to do these other two songs he had in high consideration for singles, Bones being one of them, which was our single. And I can't remember what the second song was, but we were like, please do Happen to Me. And I happened to be in the studio that day, and I watched him record, and I watched the whole attitude, the whole environment change in the studio as the musician started playing that. It was a instant uplifter. And to me, that song from the beginning, when I heard it, just the demo, I was like, this is Russell in a song. This is Russell's personality outwardly projecting. How we have to have the song at some point in time. We went with Bones as a single. Initially, he was really passionate about that song. We still thought it was a wonderful song. And we wrote that, you know, mid 24, really through the end of 24. And it was just kind of stalling out. in the charts and in streaming. And I felt like we were just deflating and losing momentum every week. And after enough of that, my team and I had a conversation and we're like, we think it's time for Happen to Me. Let's put it out. We just need a shot in the arm. We need some momentum. And we readied it at the end of 24 to go out early 25. He decided he wanted to go in and tweak some of the audio and redo it a little bit. So it was supposed to come out in January, but by the time he'd kind of retweaked it and we had to mix and master, we didn't get it until end of January. And then we were rushing to get it out in February. But we started teasing it end of January and we instantly saw it. First post, second post, third, like every post got bigger. All of them kept growing and it was organic and it was instant. And I think for that moment, I don't even know. We have to ask Russell, did he feel that confident in the song? But when we started seeing that reaction immediately online, that was 100% validation. I was like, we do have it. We have the song that is Russell as a person in a song. And those two things have met now. And we've seen what it's done for, you know, to him, for him, and to the world, because that has opened up so many avenues for him. And I think he's talked about this on podcasts I've heard him. He's like, I just started being myself. Like, I wasn't trying to be any other version of myself. And I think that song gave him the confidence of that. And that song, again, is his personality in so many ways. And once we just got those things together, Russell as himself, the song that fit Russell as a personality, it's like, it really is like a flower that bloomed and everybody got to see it and go, oh, holy shit, that guy's awesome. And this song is so great. And that's what I think it was.
I get, you know, knowing him, and of course, that song, that's a Big Machine Music song. I remember the day they wrote it. My office at the time was right next to the Matt Dragstrom's writing room. And I remember the energy of that day. And it's funny that sometimes I even forget it, but we all even heard it. We're like, we feel like this is something special, but we can be biased as publishers.
Yeah.
But I do think you have those moments. And when y'all released it, I remember we all said to say, because we see all the same numbers you guys do. You're like, oh, this feels like something really unique. The AIMP Nashville Pubcast is hosted by yours truly, Tim Hunzi. And this has been a Dime Collective production.